From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, why the League of Women Voters is focusing its efforts on lead poisoning in children this week.
Later, our Beats Me segment examines loaded ways of describing Milwaukee geography.
The consequence in the end is the cumulative consequence of creating a sense of otherness in your community.
Then what makes Milwaukee County's public golf courses so special?
It's one thing to have a course the caliber of Brown Deer, but to have as many as we have and of the different types that we have, you know, there's just so many of them.
And contributor Robert Cohen demystifies the classical music audition process.
You're having to put forward maybe 90 minutes of music, and you're going to be listened to for maybe 15 minutes. And within that 15 minutes, you're really exposing yourself to, you know, the audition panel.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Last week, we spent a lot of time exploring the challenges the region experiences in ensuring its citizens have clean water. Project Milwaukee Great Lakes Troubled Waters asked the fundamental question of why. With so much of the world's fresh water right next to us, why is access such an issue?
One problem has been lead in the water supply of many old homes, which have lead lateral lines. Lead is also a problem in old paint in homes and in the soil around houses as well. The Nonpartisan League of Women Voters is also focusing attention on lead this month. They'll host a community conversation on Saturday examining challenges of lead and specifically about testing children for lead poisoning.
The program is a follow-up to a panel the League held last November. Lake Effect's Susan Bent spoke with two League members instrumental to the project, Ann Batiza and Louise Petering. Petering explains why the League is focusing attention on this issue.
The articles that some of us read in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about the issue is basically what prompted this. That followed, of course, the Flint concern with lead in water. And so we sat at our committee meetings for several months and talked about this and said, what are we going to do about it? We have some positions, national positions, that we are able to use that talk about an environment beneficial for health and wise management of natural resources in the public interest. And water, of course, is one of the key natural resources available to human beings. And we have a health care position which begins with the prevention of disease. So it was a natural given our positions.
So I think many people would say that the more they learn about lead, the more complex it becomes.
Exactly. Actually, that was one of the things that we ran into, is that this issue has so many moving parts. And one of our former co-chairs of the Natural Resources Committee, Carol Diggeman, actually wrote a short white paper on what is known at this time. And that helped us to form a basis for further research and looking into the issue.
That also helped us determine who we would like to have at the November 17th forum, because we needed more information on the local scene to begin the process of looking at this issue.
Yeah. So in that conversation, excuse me, you had someone from the health department, you had someone from the Zilber School of Public Health. Who else was there?
We also had a practitioner from 16th Street Community Health Centers who actually goes into homes to abate homes for lead. And so, yes, we wanted to have three different perspectives on the panel because I think your perspective informs, you know, the way you look at the issue. And for such a complex issue, we really need to look at it from multiple perspectives.
So then with this upcoming event, who will people hear from?
Well, we're not going to have presentations per se. We have invited a variety of stakeholders, community leaders, scientists, practitioners, physicians, and government experts and policymakers And we really want to have a conversation that is guided by very specific questions. This first roundtable is going to address the issue of testing for lead poisoning in children. And so the questions all try to drill down on that. And, you know, our goal is that hopefully by providing a platform for conversation and also for sharing of resources, that we can prevent an unnecessary poisoning of a child in Milwaukee and move this issue forward, in, perhaps with creative solutions that come out of such conversation.
So in your own journey through this, into this deep topic, what sticks with you most?
First, what sticks with me is how much more information I need to know to really, as a league member, to do some advocacy on the behalf of the public in this city and actually around the state, because this is not an issue confined to Milwaukee. It is an issue that is all across the state where there are older infrastructures, whether it's lead pipes, whether it's paint in houses, whatever it is. So this really is a statewide issue.
Right, and actually we've invited, based on recommendations by some people in the local health department, we've invited some state members of the state public health, because, you know, our focus is on Milwaukee, but we really need to look at statewide solutions to some of these issues. For example, I was told after one of the public hearings recently at City Council that the technology for eliciting information about a child's immunizations, it pops up automatically when a doctor is doing a physical for a child, and it tells him what the dates are that they should expect the next immunization. But in order to actually access data about lead testing, they have to go into a separate database and they have to initiate that. So that is the kind of perhaps a solution that could affect great change, but requires maybe a statewide a solution.
You intend to have more roundtables and hope mm-hmm. to bring in more people into the conversation. Is that right?
Different foci. Yeah. So the second roundtable is going to look at prevention of lead poisoning, and the third one will focus more on vectors that cause lead poisoning. And so we hope that by really narrowing the conversation, but putting out as many questions about that particular issue, that we can start to drill down to innovative solutions.
So will this mean ultimately another white paper?
Possibly. We haven't gotten that far.
What is it about the mission of the league and then, of course, of this issue that drives you to try to make a difference?
Well, the league is really interested in empowering voters, and in that way to defend democracy. And one of the key ways that voters can be empowered is through education, understanding of issues that citizens need to weigh in on. And so given the complexity of this issue, our goal in bringing community leaders, scientists, as I mentioned before, government officials, practitioners to the table is so that the citizen component can become an effective mechanism for spreading the word if, you know, education at the local level is needed. And of course it is.
At every level it's needed. Yeah, the other thing is, I think we need to look at the different community groups here. This issue has brought us in contact with diverse communities within the Milwaukee area, and we greatly hope that we will continue these connections, because these are critical. Interestingly enough, I think the mindset generally, the nebulous understanding that a lot of people have is that this is a Milwaukee issue and it's an inner city issue, which it indeed is, but is not only that. And people in all communities where there is old housing need to understand this is their issue too. Whether it's here, whether it's Green Bay, whether it's La Crosse, whether it's Racine, wherever it is, we all live in homes or apartments, some of which are rather old and which do have lead exposure issues. So collaborative and capable of meeting the challenges that are before us as a population. This is one issue that has to be addressed because it affects us, not our general health, but it affects our ability to think, our ability to learn, our behaviors. So it's not just something confined to a child at a particular time in life, but it has lifelong ramifications.
I know that you testify when there's public health or environmental issues that you feel are important to be addressed. How would you rank this issue?
As a biologist, to me, ranking of issues is not the way to approach it. Basically, we live in a world where there have been connections that have supported human life for thousands of years. And so while we're focusing on this particular issue at this particular time here in Milwaukee, it's not the only one we're focusing on, but this is one of the key ones. And what's important to remember is that there are a host of issues that relate to human health. For instance, the city has the 25% renewables by 2025. How does that relate to environmental health? Well, if you reduce the amount of mercury in the environment because you're not burning as much coal, then you're going to have a lower exposure to mercury, which itself has its own health implications if it becomes incorporated into your system. So nothing is separated from anything else in this real world. So priorities are what we set as an organization, but it doesn't mean that these other issues are not relevant. So,
you know, for me, I think to me that it's so important that people are able to sit down and talk together from many different perspectives and be able to listen to one another very carefully. And so that's a big motivating factor for me, that this is such a complex issue that we need to have an open mind and we need to be able to sit down and talk to one another. At the same time, as a scientist myself, I think that rigorous application of scientific analysis is critical. But I think that because this issue has so many interrelated moving parts, that we have solutions that may be available through, as I mentioned before, perhaps maybe even mechanisms through professional societies or at different levels and through different grain sizes of society, if you will.
Ann Battiza and Louise Petering, co-chair of the League of Women Voters of Milwaukee County's Natural Resources Committee. The League's roundtable discussion, Lead Issues in Milwaukee, Testing for Lead Poisoning in Children, is Saturday afternoon in West Allis. Battiza and Petering spoke with Susan Bentz, and there is a link to more information at WUWM.com. And WUWM.com/give is where you can go to make our spring member drive a success. Bonnie North, we need to hear from a number of listeners during this hour of Lake Effect, right?
We sure do. 9 members, new or renewing this hour in order to stick with our goals. And when you make a contribution to WUWM.com, you are making a contribution to support programming like Project Milwaukee. That special series all last week, we had a live Lake Effect We had reports all during Morning Edition and during Lake Effect examining the problem of clean drinking water in Milwaukee and in Wisconsin. And that's exactly what you are supporting when you make a contribution at WUWM.com/give.
Right. Let's use that live Lake Effect as an example. We received support from a number of different sources, including American Public Media, to make that event possible. But the most important source in making both that event and the series possible in general is you, our listeners, and people who have over the years stepped up to the plate and come through in the clutch, to use some sports metaphors here, and supported this station and supported this show over the years. WUWM.com/give. We need to hear from 9 new members or renewing members who are playing a role in keeping the station healthy.
Whether you are new or renewing, the important thing is that you think that the programming you hear on WUWM is worth your financial support, because quite honestly, we really can't do it without that support. So we are hoping to hear from you. Go to WUWM.com/give, whether it's $5, $50, or $500. We thank you very much, and we look forward to hearing from you soon.
We'll take a quick break now, and then another feature that's made possible with the support of listeners. Our race and ethnicity reporter will answer a listener question during our Beats Me segment, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
We are back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. It's time for our latest installment of Beats Me, the series that allows you to ask questions that our beat reporters investigate.
Today, WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell takes a look at the impact of using loaded words, such as labels that describe certain areas of Milwaukee.
Inner city is a term that may ignite many thoughts. I found one dictionary definition that says the inner city is the usually older, poorer, and more densely populated central section of a city. And I found a travel site that 2 years ago advised people visiting Milwaukee to stay away from certain areas in the inner city, including the northern part of the city. It's this kind of language that has one of our listeners calling for a stop in using the label inner city.
I've always kind of resented the fact that most of the labeling comes from the press and from suburbanites. And one of them that's particularly annoying is inner city, because the implication.
For some insight on the topic, I sat down with Dr. Pat Mays, an English professor at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She says there's referential meaning in language.
You might understand it as the denotation. So that would be like the literal meaning.
Then there's social and affective meanings that have subtle meanings and connotations. Mays says speakers may not always be fully aware of the impact. But she says connotations behind inner city or north side are a good example of how language can change over time.
We might have started using north side as a kind of a literal, in a literal way, to refer to a particular area of the city. But then through use and associations with certain kinds of negative things like crime, police activity, then these words can take on negative meaning.
So who's responsible for creating those associations? Keith Woods of NPR thinks the media play a huge role. He's vice president of newsroom training and diversity.
In communities, when you say inner city, which is a geographic location, too often we are not talking about a geographic location at all, but the race and class of the people who live in a community. And until we stop using those code words and simply say what we mean, like, you know, in this case of inner city, what people are saying is poor and black or brown. Until you start saying it straight up, the language will continue to be encoded. And when you encode language that way, you create a sense of us and them.
Woods says that can have larger sociological and societal consequences. So what do people who live in what some consider the inner city think about the label? I visited the Sherman Phoenix, a hub of Black-owned businesses, on Fond du Lac Avenue to find out. Some say they avoid the term because of its negative implications. For instance, that it pertains to underprivileged or under-resourced communities. Evan Figures says she associates the label with poverty and says people who aren't from the area probably think the same.
The inner city is where we get all the bad media and the bad exposure.
Selena Redd, who lives near Rufus King High School, says there are preconceived notions about people who live on the north side, that people are hopeless, jobless, or uneducated. But she says she doesn't take it personally when she hears the term inner city.
There's this sense, especially in the city, of division. So segregation is so serious in the city, and I think we often we buy into those preconceived notions and that, you know, if we move to the suburbs, we've made it or whatever. But the same issues that happen in the city of Milwaukee are happening in the suburbs. Just don't hear about it.
Redd says these terms can be problematic, but only because people give them power and they don't have to. So what can we do? Changing language and its meanings doesn't happen overnight. But being aware of the implications of what we say can be a first step in the right direction. Taryn Powell, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Support for Race and Ethnicity Reporting is provided by The Doman Company.
Taryn Powell is WUWM's Race and Ethnicity Reporter. You can listen to previous Beats Me segments or ask your own question of one of our beat reporters at WUWM.com. WUWM.com/give is the place where you can play a role in our spring member drive. And, you know, it's interesting. Both the spring member drive and our Beats Me segments are two good examples of how our listeners, whether they're on terrestrial radio or online, are playing a role in shaping the future of this station.
That financial support is exactly what helps shape the future of this station and the health of things like race and ethnicity reporting. Perhaps it's environment that's really interesting to you. We have a business and innovation reporter. We have an education reporter. We cover the arts. We cover all of it. And we do that because of your support. You know, you might be able to afford $10 a month. And if you can and you become a sustaining member, that's fantastic. And we thank you very much for that generosity. Maybe you can only afford $5 this time around. That's okay, too. The amount isn't important. What's important is that we hear from 9 people today during this hour of Lake Effect, whether you are a brand new contributor or whether you are a longtime contributor who's making another contribution. We just need to hear from you. WUWM.com/give is the place to go.
It's really easy to kind of sit back and let somebody else do the work. You know, there are lots of times when just kind of sitting there and letting it all happen is the easy way to go about things. But what we really need is for you to take an active role and, you know, keep this station healthy, keep Lake Effect healthy for years to come. Do it now. Go to WUWM.com/give and play a role in our spring member drive.
We will take another break and then learn what makes the system of public golf courses in Milwaukee so special. You are listening to Lake Effect from listener-supported Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. If the last couple of days are any indication, spring may be finally sticking with us. For some people, that might mean the chance to get out and work in the yard, and others might be relishing the opportunity for spring sports, maybe softball or outdoor volleyball or maybe even golf.
The May issue of Milwaukee Magazine features 2 covers. The traditional front cover focuses on fitness, but if you flip the magazine upside down and onto its back, you will find another cover and a series of articles devoted to golf. Chris Drosner is executive editor of the magazine, and he is with us to talk about an article in particular and about the special issue in general.
The regular issue that it's paired with is the health issue, and you know, with that falling in May as it did, we thought that you know, that golf would be a fun subset of that. There's a lot of excitement around golf in the Milwaukee area right now, with the Ryder Cup coming up next year at Whistling Straits, and We wanted to kind of do just a celebration of golf and put together, you know, kind of do what we do and focus it on that one topic for a single, you know, kind of truncated issue.
You mentioned Whistling Straits, and that's obviously the course that gets a ton of attention in Wisconsin. There's some others as well, Holy Hill, for example. Mm-hmm. But we're going to talk specifically about the courses within the Milwaukee County Park System. And people might have forgotten that there have been some pretty significant golf tournaments in at least one of those courses over the years, and that's Brown Deer Park, which holds a significance for one of the most famous golfers of our generation.
Yeah, we had no idea that right around the time that this issue was coming out that Tiger Woods would become, again, like, you know, the biggest story in golf. And he made his debut. I mean, the reason this is relevant is because he made his professional debut at Brown Deer, including a round that, a tournament that included a hole-in-one by him. So that's pretty cool. I mean, talk about a unique entry in the entire history of the sport. That's a pretty cool one.
Right. You think about the big names in golf, and Tiger Woods was a big name pretty much from the time he stepped on a course as a professional, and that all goes back to what was then the first hole at Brown Deer where he teed off, and I gather that hole is now number 10.
Yes, that's correct.
And there's a plaque for the place mm-hmm. where he teed
off.
Yeah,
if you're going through on your round at Brown Deer, which, I mean, one of the things I was really excited about with this issue was kind of highlighting this, probably underappreciated locally treasure of the Milwaukee County Golf System, the crown jewel of which is Brown Deer, which obviously has this great history, but is also just a great course. I mean, it held a PGA tour tournament for many, many years in the GMO, too.
Well, and you say underappreciated, and I think going from golf course to golf course, you forget that not every metropolitan area has public courses that are this impressive.
Right, right. I mean, it's one thing to have a course the caliber of Brown Deer, but to have as many as we have and of the different types that we have, you know, there's just so many of them. And you mentioned you kind of just driving around and like, oh, there's another course. That's about access to people who, you know, live anywhere in the city or the county. There's a public golf course that's pretty low cost that they can play right there.
Right. Brown Deer is not the least expensive in the world, but compared to some private courses, it really is pretty mm-hmm. cost effective. But there's a course that has not really been on my radar screen, but perhaps should for anybody who is kind of starting in this sport, and that's the Lake Park course.
Yeah, this one was new to me too. So there's a small small course at Lake Park, you know, right in the middle of everything on the east side there. And, you know, that was completed in 1898. So that's pretty old for golf courses.
You got a great picture here of the course in 1914.
Right, right. Yeah. And I think this is one that is perfect for, I mean, when I think about playing golf, it's like, okay, this is going to be most of the day. But this is a very short course. It's just a par three. And so, you know, I mean, in and out, just a few bucks, it seems perfect for just, you know, like a couple hours. Not
$9 even. To play this
right,
course.
Exactly.
50 cents a hole.
That's good value.
Yeah. Say a couple of words about the guy that this article describes as the dean of county golf. This is a guy that if you don't know of, you probably should.
Yeah. Archie Dadian. I think it's Dadian. I'm sorry, we didn't pronounce it, but in the print business, we don't have to worry about that. But he was the author Doug Moe describes as the most prolific or the kind of the best golfer to emerge from the county golf system. And he's 85 now. He started playing when he was a teenager. He's won a few state amateurs and turned pro for a little bit, but kind of, you know, didn't really stick, but he's been he's like the local legend essentially of this great system. And the story that we wrote has a lot of texture to it, and I really kind of want to meet him. Seems like a great guy to kind of play around with. He still plays at 85, so
What is the story of how these courses have continued to survive and succeed in an era in which things like park funding is are kind of a challenge?
Yeah, I mean that's one of the things that I think is pretty exemplary about this. Is I mean we know that the Milwaukee County Park System has some significant infrastructure and maintenance challenges, and I mean I think one of the reasons the golf operation has been so stable is that it is a revenue producer. It's actually helping support other aspects of the park system. So I've done some work recently in Madison where the opposite is happening, and there's discussion about closing at least one of the courses and you know selling this major asset or at least converting it to other uses because it's not supporting itself. So you know that this is happening again with such a large system that has you know a lot of infrastructure and maintenance and all that is pretty remarkable.
We talk about easy access to some of these courses. There is one course that this article includes that is the outlier, and it is not a public course. What's the Milwaukee Country Club doing in this article? Compare and contrast.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah, that was an interesting one because the Milwaukee Country Club does not like to talk about itself. they were very hesitant to. Apparently, they don't do any advertising, and we had to kind of convince them. Well, this isn't advertising. This is just talking about what you do. but it's widely considered one of the best courses in the state. You know, it's up there in the Golf Digest, you know, top 100 courses in America ranking, that sort of thing. One of the sources refers to it as the greatest course in the state, period, in terms of history and stature.
And I gather the pros speak about just what a challenging place it is to play.
Right. I mean, we can only guess, right, Mitch? But we'll have to take their word for it, yeah.
Indeed. Well, Chris Drosner, thanks so much.
Appreciate it, Mitch.
Chris Drosner is executive editor of Milwaukee Magazine. The article about Milwaukee County's public golf courses is in the May issue, which features a full section on golf. You'll find a link to more information at WUWM.com. And at WUWM.com/give is a place where you can make a contribution. Whether you play golf or outdoor volleyball or, like me, ride a bike when the weather turns nice, it's a perfect time to think about supporting the public radio station where you hear all of this content every single day.
Quite honestly, I'm most excited this spring about getting to go to my children's outdoor events without freezing my tush off.
That's good. And you can take photos without your fingers freezing to the camera.
Right. So WUWM.com/give is the place to go to become one of the 9 members, either new or renewing members, that we are after during this spring membership drive. And the interview we just heard with Chris Drosner of Milwaukee Magazine is a great example of the many partnerships that Lake Effect has forged with other media organizations, whether it's the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service or Milwaukee Magazine or the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel or any number of media outlets out there. It's a great way for us to kind of leverage the other expertise that exists out in the community.
Right. We can't possibly know everything, even though
we like to pretend we do. Yes,
pretend we do. But it's really wonderful when we can reach out to our colleagues in different media outlets and say, hey, come on and talk about this thing you've been working on for a long time. And they can bring all of that research and information to bear. And it helps you become more informed about the city and area that you live in. And that is a wonderful partnership. And the other partnership, of course, that makes that happen is the one that we have with you, the financial partnership. And so WUWM.com/give is the place to go to make your partnership part of this membership drive.
One more break, and then we'll talk with a different kind of contributor. Contributor Robert Cohen joins us for his monthly conversation about the life of a professional classical musician. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
It's Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Every month, we chat with contributor Robert Cohen about the life and work of a touring classical musician in a series we call On That Note.
This month, we realized that over the years we've been doing this segment, we have never talked about the audition process that musicians go through. Cohen says, fortunately, he's past the point where he has to worry about upcoming auditions.
When I started out in my career, I was entering competitions and doing auditions for all sorts of things. And it was kind of a terrifying experience. And now, of course, what I'm doing is sitting on the other side of the table, or sometimes even the screen. You know, sometimes auditions are held behind a screen, which is really odd, because you know that they can't see you and you can't see them. And you can't actually even hear that well, because sound, you know, normally comes directly to you, but there's this kind of, I don't know, wooden screen or a material screen blocking out half the sound. And that's quite disturbing when you're trying to consider how somebody's performing. And it's kind of disturbing, I'm sure, to be playing into a curtain. And the other type of auditioning that we're having a lot of these days is kind of video or audio that's sent as a first round, say, for a competition. So, you know, 150 people will send in their videos, which are made, I don't know, sometimes just on their mobile phones, or maybe, you know, somebody's got better equipment at their school or something like that. So when you sit down, like I did actually today, I was sitting on an auditioning panel for a competition and listening to a lot of different people playing, and sometimes they're playing just like, you know, a few feet away from their little telephone, which is recording them playing some major repertoire. Other times it's quite professional. And, you know, I feel for them. I think it's so stressful to be that person wondering how they should play. I think people very often wonder how they should play to impress the jury, as we're called sometimes. I mean, that's such a terrible expression, isn't it? But we are the auditioning panel, and they practice and try to make everything as perfect as possible. And sometimes they try to play in a way that they won't offend people's, you know, the jury's opinions about music. So they might try to play in a very neutral fashion. I know students often say to me, oh, I shouldn't be too expressive. You know, if I play Bach in a certain fashion and then one jury member really hates it, that's not going to be good for me. So maybe I'll just play it in a very neutral, inoffensive way. So you get people setting themselves up with all these expectations of what the jury might think.
That's one of the things that's so hard if you're the person auditioning, unless it's a particular orchestra that you know what that sound is that the orchestra produces. And so you know whether your sound matches that or can fit into that or not. You're guessing. You're just guessing what the jury might like or not like in your playing. It seems to me that you just need to play the way you play.
Well, that's what I always say to my students before they do an audition. I always just say, you just have to be honest and play the way you feel, because it's also no good being chosen for a way that you don't normally play, because then you're going to be out of place, aren't you?
Yeah.
I mean, I even know a very famous musician who did a big international solo competition, and he decided on a plan of action. He decided how to play to please the jury that he knew who the jury members were, because their names had been published. And he had a sense that he should play his repertoire in a certain way, and also his choice of repertoire for the competition. And he actually won the competition. But for literally 20 years afterwards, he was complaining bitterly because he said, well, people are really expecting me to play like that, and it's not how I would like to play, and I don't want to play that way. But, you know, there's this kind of pressure on me to do it that way.
And right, and I did it this way in order to get that competition. That was the only reason. Yeah.
Honesty is the only policy, really. But it's tricky also, because some competitions, they expect you to choose some of the repertoire yourself. So they might give you some guidelines, or they might say, choose from this list. And then, you know, you have to decide what you think will be most impressive, or what shows your qualities. And what I find being on the jury very often is, I think, how interesting that they should have chosen those pieces. When I'm listening to a violinist play a certain piece, I'll think, you know, why would they choose that? Given their qualities, why would they choose that piece? And I find it very intriguing, because sometimes the player actually is not the best person to choose what works well for them. And I think sometimes people do literally choose the wrong repertoire and kind of get knocked out of the competition just because they didn't choose the right things.
Right, set themselves up for failure from the get-go.
That's right. And, you know, the thing is, we're talking about quite a lot of time. I mean, this is not like these TV shows where somebody is trying to show their talent and they sing a song for 2 minutes or something like that. In these competitions, sometimes you're having to put forward maybe 90 minutes of music, and you're going to be listened to initially for maybe 15 minutes. And within that 15 minutes, you're really exposing yourself to, you know, the audition panel. They're going to see an awful lot about what you do, how you do it, your technique, your choices of music, all of these things, your musicality. And very often, you know, just the question of whether you can engage with the jury, because this is a major problem when you're, for instance, looking at video auditioning section. You're just watching video after video. Some people are, you know, their videos are recorded at a concert, so you get a feeling of occasion, and you can sense that the artist is, you know, playing to the audience. And like I said before, other times you get somebody literally, they've just propped up their cell phone and they're playing to it in their bedroom. And you just wonder, is that person engaging with you, the person watching, in the right way? And those are kind of critical factors. And I think it's very hard when you're recording those things to have a sense, you know, you're just going to send it off. And, in, you know, it's very, very anonymous.
Right.
You're not playing to anybody. You don't know who's going to hear it. And you've got to somehow perform in a way that is impressive. And when we watch those videos or those performances, it's really most often the performers who grab your attention, because, you know, they just, there's something about their playing that is so riveting that you just put your pencil down, stop writing notes, and stop deciding what their mark might be, and just really enjoy the music and feel, you know, super impressed that they are just grabbing your attention. Those are the ones that make the day enjoyable, because it can be very hard otherwise.
Somewhat excruciating, I would imagine, particularly hearing the same piece over and over and over and over.
That's true. You do often have to do that.
Yeah. Now, in a perfect world, how would you change the audition process to make it both representative of the people auditioning and also taking into account, you know, the people who are doing the judging? What would be some of the things that you would do if you could?
Well, I suppose, you know, there's limits. I mean, first of all, if you have a competition that's trying to select somebody to be a potential new young star as a soloist, you initially need to know that they have, you know, a minimum standard, that they're technically able, and that they have some, you know, qualities in their playing. So I think initially you do those videos or audition processes have to take place. But I think then after that point, perhaps giving, you know, if you're really selecting two or three top level people, that's when you need these live events. And that, there are competitions, of course, and many that have the final rounds in public, and everybody gets to hear this person perform a solo or with orchestra in front of an audience, and really feel the atmosphere and whether this is an artist more than just a player. And those kind of things are, they're well established, that process. But I think for auditions for orchestras and things like that, usually the best process is that if somebody is basically of a minimum level, that they immediately then get some sort of trial with the orchestra. It's another one of these words that sounds like jury and trial. It sounds so terrible. But, you know, that somebody gets an invitation to sit into the orchestra and play with them for a certain amount of time and see how they get on with their colleagues and whether they contribute nicely and whether they're going to fit in with, you know, their style, their sound, and all the things that you mentioned before. And that, of course, also does happen as well. So I'm not sure there's a lot of improvement that can be made. But on the other hand, there are many competitions which are sadly really rigged. And this is a major problem for the music world, because a lot of competitions which are important international competitions are obviously selecting winners who may also represent in some form their teachers, their previous teachers or their present teachers. So of course it becomes not just about whether somebody plays brilliantly, but who they learnt with. And there is a major problem in the international competition setup, which is that teachers are very much involved in being jury members. And in a really fair situation, no teacher should be judging when their own students are on the competition, because otherwise that's bias, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I was going to say it's a built-in bias right there. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's very, very common. And in fact, the kind of career of certain teachers is reliant on having competition, their students winning competitions. Because if your student wins a big competition, then obviously more young artists will come to you to study because they think, well, this must be a great teacher. And also they're not naive. They also know that this is a kind of route to possibly winning competitions.
Which then, of course, if you win that competition, then you get lucrative contracts for performances or other invitations, which can make your career.
Indeed, those are very important competitions to win. It also brings into question whether music really can be in any way a competitive thing, because, you know, I think all musicians know that you can't really judge one person from another. Not really like one person goes first and next person goes second, because it's really very subjective.
Yeah.
And it's very much a question of how that artist is that evening, you know, whether they are playing the music that they really love, you know, whether they're really healthy at that moment, whether they collaborate well with the conductor or the orchestra. There are so many variables that, you know, when you're talking about a selection of very, very fine performers, and then you're trying to put them in some sort of order, I don't think music can be measured in that way. But it's kind of, you know, the competitions are being promoted all over the world. I mean, I constantly receive information asking me to put my students forward for yet another competition that's just, you know, risen from somewhere. I mean, literally, competitions are all over the place. Every country has thousands of them. And in a way, that's caused another problem, which is that there are so many competitions that they lose their value because,
right,
you know, somebody came to audition today for a competition, and I looked at their CV, which shows that they've already won 15 other competitions. And I'm thinking, well, surely if these competitions are worthwhile, why do you need to do 15 of them? And
or,
yet
or
another
16th,
one.
And here
yes,
you are doing the 16th, yeah. Well, and it makes me think, you know, human beings aren't widgets. You know, when you get past you assume a certain technical skill and standard, you assume, you know, a certain amount of training to get to a certain high level. At that point, it becomes subjective and it's a matter of taste. And I think we do a disservice to music when we try to do that, when we try to fit people into these little narrow categories at that level. You know, I think competitions might be great as you're working your way up as a young musician to learn how to perform under pressure, to, you know, to win some, to lose some, whatever it is, to kind of get the idea that, you know, I have to bring my A game to every
yes,
performance that I do. But once you get to a certain level,
I think, you know, of course, naturally, the reason why you do it and the reason why I did it back in the day was because you want exposure. You want to be seen, and you hopefully you'll be seen by somebody. And it's often the case you can be seen by somebody on the jury, some eminent musician, so that even if you don't win the competition, that person, you know, will come to you and say, look, I loved your playing. I want you to come and play here. I want you to do this. And they will start promoting you in their own way. And of course, that's what we want. We all want a break. We all want the chance to be seen and to be heard. But it has become so commercial in a way, which is disappointing. You know, people are prepared to put money up for another competition. I mean, there are competitions where people win $20,000-$30,000. And you think, well, I'm sure if that person, you know, instead of just putting it into competition, how about putting that into a concert series where you invite people to play
and
give concerts, you know,
and pay them.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, there are so many good ways to support the art. We don't really need another competition.
Well, Robert, I don't know that we have the answer, but as always, I'm so happy to be talking with you about it and thinking about it, and I look forward to catching up with you again next month.
Me too. Lovely to talk to you, Bonnie.
Robert Cohen is a professional cellist and a regular Lake Effect contributor. We reached him at his home in London. We'd like to hear from another kind of regular Lake Effect contributor, and that is the kind that has become a sustaining member of WUWM, or we'd like to hear from somebody who might become a regular contributor to Lake Effect, maybe a new member like you. Take a couple of minutes right now and go to wuwm.com/give and become a member. Register your support today.
People like Robert give their time to do this. We don't pay him. This is something that he and all of our contributors do. They donate their time because they believe in Lake Effect. They believe in WUWM. And this is a way that they make a contribution. Well, we need you to make a financial contribution to help us continue to bring these varied voices that you hear on Lake Effect. And so whether it is $10 a month, $100, or maybe a one-time contribution of $500. Any amount is welcome. The important thing is that we hear from you, you become a member, and we thank you very much for your support.
That is all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today and for making a contribution. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. It is 11 o'clock and fresh air comes your way next.